Thank you for listening to CASDA EdCast, where we explore issues and ideas of K-12 education and speak with teachers and administrators about their experiences serving the needs of students in our region.
Greetings, everyone. Happy New Year, 2020. I am so glad to be back. And here I have my friend Tracy Sungar, who is an educator in the North County School District. My name is Kathleen McLean. I'm with the McLean Group. Our work focuses on equity, leadership, and team building. I had this conversation with Mike actually a couple months ago, and we are continuing the conversation. I want to talk about again why I got into the work of equity. My daughter was born and raised April 18, 1995, and we had moved here from Brooklyn, New York, myself and my husband. We were around predominantly brown and black communities. Then we got to Latham, and I did experience culture shock. And my daughter, fast forward, when I had her, she ended up, you know, going to kindergarten, first grade, second grade. But second grade, something interesting happened. Danielle came home, and she went upstairs, went to the linen closet, took a yellow towel, put it on her head, and began to swing her hair around. And myself, I just wondered, I'm like, what is going on here? I didn't understand. And once I did a little more investigation, I realized that Danielle was struggling with her racial identity. She was trying to emulate the white girls in her class because she was different. Her hair was braided, it had barrettes, it had beads, those kinds of different hairstyles. And I think because she didn't see anyone at all in her school, in the hallway, in her books, in anything that looked like her. And I realized Danielle was struggling with her racial identity development. And that's when I went to the school and started to do some volunteer work. Mr. Martin at the time was so gracious, allowed me to come in and do a workshop for the educators, as well as go into the classroom, her second grade classroom. I bought multicultural books and read them. And that's how I started the work. And so now I am working and have been working with several school districts throughout New York State. And some of my experiences in the work is really looking, have people look at themselves. And one thing we use is a tool called the Intercultural Effectiveness Scale, where people will examine themselves. And the whole point of this tool that people go online and do for 20 minutes and then it's printed out and myself or a team member takes them through the process is really examining how comfortable are you with differences. And in that conversation, recently I did it with a group of people. They were very, very uncomfortable and very, very disappointed in their results. But let's face it, people, black people, brown people, biracial, multiracial people, Indian, you name it, race, ethnicity, we do not play together, we do not pray together, and we do not live together. So therefore, the results of the intercultural effectiveness scale that we're looking at are not at all surprising when people actually sit down and take an inventory and say, how comfortable am I with difference when I'm not even around people that are different? So we do that, and then once we do that, I've used the Tatum text, Why Are All the Black Children Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? Cafeteria by Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, and I've also used Waking Up White by Debbie Irving. I found those texts to be quite profound in helping people understand, and all people, but particularly white people, with Debbie Irving's book, where she takes everyone on a journey from her experiences as a child, middle school, high school, college, and now as a woman in her 50s, how so much of her life was centered around whiteness and didn't realize how much whiteness impacted or hurt other people. Now, in the conversations, for example, with both texts, I remember an educator said to me, I felt like this was very revelatory for her. She said, Kathleen, can I say black? I said to her, yes, you can. You can say black. But she didn't know that was okay. She thought it was offensive or an insult if she called someone black if they were black. That is one where I was really struck about the limited interaction this individual had with people of color. another school I was at just recently, the person, educator, I believe was in her early 50s or late 50s, said the first time she interacted with someone who was not white or met someone was in college. So her 0 through 18 years, she had never been around a black person. And what she saw of black people or brown people was what she saw on TV. So other experiences in the work are people, after going through those dialogues and then going through the 2.5 days or 2 days of training where we look at a workshop on unconscious bias, microaggressions, a workshop on exploring discipline disproportionality, a workshop on, you know, tactics and how do you, what are the strategies for discipline disproportionality. And people have said to us that it was life-changing, life-transforming, and that they had no idea about how small, and some people use the word sheltered, their social construct was. Or there's another activity we do where we say, okay, put a, if your dentist, like if you give people, like say, marbles or some kind of things that have color, well, what color the race of your dentist, the race of the of your cashier, when you go to Price Chapel or Hannaford or Walmart, the race of certain people. And people start to say, wow, I live in a very segregated community. Though we've come far, we still have a ways to go. Even though the water fountain doesn't say, don't drink here, there are still systems in place. Even though the words have been erased, they're still there, invisible. And people know where to stay in their place. But in the work, continue to do the work, I find that people are being more open, people are listening, and have altered some of their practices based on having those conversations. One person said to me, I've taken this book home, I've shared it with my spouse, I've shared it with my, you know, I've started to have conversations. And he said to me, white people, as my experience, I've never talked about race, but because of talking about race and getting comfortable to talk about race, I'm realizing that now I'm able to talk about race and take it outside of the classroom and bringing it to my family, my friends, and my community.
Hi, I'm Tracy Sangari. I'm in my 23rd year of teaching. I teach English language learners, and I work in an elementary school. In the year 2017, 2018, the school year is when Kathleen came, the McLean Group, and ran our first diversity cohort in our district. It was something that I had never imagined a district would do, to sit and talk about race, especially with predominantly white participants in it. And it really opened up a lot of dialogue in our district. We had administrators in the cohort, our superintendent and assistant superintendent were both there. And I think that was something that was really important that we did, because it set a tone for our district that this was important right from the top on down. And what is important to me is right now just talking about like a call to action. What we did with the McLean Group was just the beginning. And I think too many schools and too many districts see that as their endpoint. Okay, we did the diversity thing. We talked about diversity. We're all set. What's the next thing we're going to do? But that really needs to be the starting point for all districts, is now that we've started talking about this, what are the actions we're going to take in our district? And right now, when we look at our schools, too many students of color and too many families of color are not being served by our schools. I mean, that's a fact. You can see it when we look at our New York State, the audits that they do for suspensions, for gifted programs, for AP programs. Our students are not all being served. We say that we're serving all of our students, but there's a very startling statistics out there about what is actually happening in our schools. And so I want to start talking about what's the next step for districts. How do we start looking at curriculum? How do we start looking at our programs? And how do we start making our schools equitable places for kids to be? Kathleen, you said something about how you had a little bit of a culture shock moving up here. And it made me think about how one of my friends recently made the comment that we white people, we move to areas. I live in a very white area. And then all of a sudden we start bemoaning how nothing is diverse around us, how our church is not diverse, our places of worship are not diverse, our schools are not diverse. And then this is what something we intentionally did. And then we try to play the other side of the coin by saying, wait, there's no diversity here.
But I think that's a good point in terms of, Tracy, you're saying, right, there's no diversity there, but there's a historical context. There's something called redlining,
right,
where intentionally the banks drew red lines around black and brown neighborhoods and would not support and help people who lived in these neighborhoods. They would not be able to get loans. But it wasn't only the bank. It was the federal government that was behind this and realtors. So it was a whole system against people of color owning property. And there was a recent study I read recently where it shows, I mean, home ownership is the key to economic elevation. You know, I own a home and I can, if I choose to take out a home equity loan to pay for my, I have four children and one in law school and two others that are about, two in college right now, another one about to go, I could take out a home equity loan. Now, if you don't own a home, how do you take out a home equity loan?
Exactly.
But there's also generational wealth, mm-hmm, right? And so your grandparents have a home. I hear people say it all the time. When I am in these circles of white people, oh, my great grandmother gave my grandmother the house, mm-hmm, and then my grandmother is going to give the house to me. Now, if you have a house that you've been given, then you don't have to pay for it. That, how do you compete with somebody who couldn't, because of redlining, their parents lost the home? And what black families did at the time in order to keep their homes, they would go to loan sharks. And the loan sharks would charge five times the price or more, then they couldn't keep it. And so then they have no home. So how can you, that's not apples and oranges. And when people say, you know, this idea of pull yourself by your bootstraps, there's been so many supports for white people that they don't have, they're not pulling themselves by their bootstraps. So people say, oh, affirmative action, but who benefits from affirmative action? Mostly white women. Who benefits from some of these other programs, the GI Bill? Right? So we had people coming back from the war and they can get money to buy homes. And even though black people could not get those, mm-hmm, same exact loans. So there's a disproportionate economics plays such a driving force. And then if we bring it down to the schools, right? I live in the North County School District, pay taxes for your schools. So if you live in different school districts, your taxes, if you don't own a home, in many of these schools, you don't have the resources. These schools are less funded, and they don't have the resources to provide the same things as some of these other school districts. Mm-hmm. So it really comes down to economics.
Yeah. And what you're saying, too, actually makes me think about educators who want to do this work, who want to do better, who want to take this call to action and do something. It's not just about like grabbing a book about culturally relevant teaching. It's about knowing history. So it's about like picking up Dr. Kendi's stamp from the beginning and understanding the history of what has happened in this country and how we've limited opportunities for many groups of people. And people are not just at a starting point right now. We're talking about generations of people being denied rights, you know, generations of people having things taken away from them. I mean, when you think about slavery and what happened after slaves were freed, you know, what happened to people, slaves leaving plantations and how they had nowhere to go, where you had soldiers, you know, white soldiers who are given land to go out west. And what is happening? People are, you know, we're moving to areas of opportunity, but they had no resources. And how this gets played out again and again then with people who don't have the family that's passing down the house or passing down money or whose family don't have the connections in their town of, you know, if something goes wrong and I'm going to call so-and-so, you know, who works for the town, who can help us out with this. There's so many layers to this. And it's not just about what we're teaching in our classroom. It's about understanding the history of our country.
Right. The historical context is key. But you said social networks.
Mm-hmm.
Those are so critical. I hear people say it all the time. I was talking to a former social worker who she tells me her son is white and how he got in tons and tons and tons of trouble. But they said that they got some really good lawyers
mm-hmm.
that got him out of those situations and even alluded to the fact that the judge was a family friend.
Right.
So you walk into, and then we look at the disproportionate number of black and brown people incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
For the same infraction a black person does and a white person does, it's not the same. They might not even get to the level of any penalty whatsoever.
Right.
You know, if you have a lawyer on retainer, then how could you possibly compete? The other thought I had with social networks was the opportunities once you do, in high school, getting a job. People tell me, oh, I just called my friend. He hired my son to do this work and hired my daughter to do this work. Right? Oh, and my, you know, and so having those social networks elevates you, and you don't even have to think about it. You just be like, oh, just call your friend.
Right.
But not everybody has mm-hmm. that access and that ability to do that because they don't have those social networks.
Right. And that's what, see, like you had said about having an attorney on retainer, and it's not even, I'm sure a lot of people are like, well, I don't have the money for that, but it's, I don't either. But I mean, I grew up in this area, and if I needed an attorney, I know that I'd be able to find somebody that could help me find an attorney, somebody that, you know, would help me find somebody that I could afford. And not everybody has, you know, those connections. I think of that often about how, you know, I make noise about things that upset me. And part of that is my privilege as a white woman, that I can do that. And people might not like me, but they don't see me as threatening. They don't see me as, I don't even think people would see me as loud, but I can make that
more loud.
I speak out a lot. I try to speak out a lot about things. And, but I think of the way that people are viewed, when they speak out and who is given space to say things and who is being seen as, you know, I think sometimes I speak out and it's like, oh, that's Tracy's issue. She talks out about that. And then if a black woman talks about the same thing, it's sort of viewed as, oh, you know, well, like, you know, this is affecting her and, you know, she has like an underlying reason to talk about this. And it's seen as ulterior motives. I feel like I'm given like some grace mm-hmm. that other people are not given.
But one thing I definitely, besides many other things I appreciate the fact that you definitely use your privilege to speak up against things that are not right. And I definitely appreciate that about you, Tracy. And I know it's probably not led you to have a lot of, I'm sure there are people who have exited your life mm-hmm. as a result of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remind myself, I think about Debbie Irving. I had met her last year when I went to the conference at the YWCA. She wrote the book, Waking Up White.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Debbie, how many friends have you lost as a result of your social activism and anti-racist stance? She said, nobody that counts.
Yep.
And I'll never forget that. But I think that, you know, I've lost people that are white and because of my stance.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel that as long as I'm Kathleen, because I'm friendly, I'm lovable, I bring cookies, I bring cakes, I bring joy, I bring happiness where I go. As long as they don't have to look at my blackness, then they're okay with being my friend.
Mm-hmm.
And as then when I mention, you know, by the way, I am black too, then it's like, oh no,
mm-hmm.
then they no longer want to be my friend. And I've had that those very, very hurtful experiences with women who I thought were really close friends to me, but then realized what I was posting on Facebook, which I post articles and different things about race and white privilege. And they're like, oh, what you post offends me.
Mm-hmm.
One of my friends told me, and I said, well, let's talk about it. And that was our last conversation,
mm-hmm.
you know? So,
I think it's taking me, although I've been like outspoken about things, I think it's taking me a while to really understand white privilege. And I think that like, as I started to understand it more, like I really just saw that I had to use my privilege and I still beat myself up about, I really try. Cause again, I'm talking about Dr. Kendi again, but he wrote How to Be an Anti-Racist. And if you're the opposite of, if you can't just not be a racist, you have to be anti-racist, because not being a racist and being quiet is being complicit. And that's bowing down to the people who are really being hateful. So being actively anti-racist and speaking up is, I mean, that's really what I try to aim to do, but I'm not there, and I'm not always there. And I still feel like there are times that I let things go. I just recently said to one of my friends, like, oh my gosh, like I needed to get this work done. And then this person drops this on my lap, and I'm like, oh, do I ever get to just have a day where I can get done what I need to do and not have to say, yeah, but like, when you say that, like, what do you mean by that? Because the way it sounds to me is very hurtful. I think so. That, I mean, that's been my goal, is try to be actively anti-racist. And and that's been my, ever since reading that book, with Dr. Kendi's book, it's also been my goal in my classroom that my curriculum be actively anti-racist too. Which I think for a long time it wasn't. You know, when I first started teaching 23 years ago, it was enough for me to have books that had characters of color in it. And that to me was presenting a diverse book to my students. And I didn't look at where, what story was being told in the book, or who was telling the story, or even how people were represented. I had told a story about a picture book. It was called Amazing Grace, that I loved, of a young black girl who did all these adventurous things. And there was a picture in it, and it said she played Pocahontas, and she's dressed in a very stereotypical outfit of an indigenous person. And I had such a hard time letting go of that book, because I was so tied to this book. I loved this book, and she, you know, was a young black girl being strong. And I had to say, like, but it's hurtful. And it, you know, I've got to let go of this, because I can't be doing something hurtful with my students.
And I'll tell you, with my experience with my four children in the school district, and of course, broadly talking to many parents of color who call me, teaching and talking to many kids, when slavery is taught, the whole idea of slavery, and every child came home and said, "Mommy, that was a terrible segment in our classroom." Because all the white children looked at me. And I, as a parent, my heart hurt. And even just thinking to myself, there is a way to teach it without making everyone feel really yucky. And the approach, I think, is really important. It's saying maybe, okay, these people were enslaved. It's not because they were inferior. It's because it was an evil system that was sanctioned by many people. Like, there's a way to teach it. And even maybe having the young people go into small groups and talking about it amongst themselves and giving them like writing prompts or whatever way they're going to do it. But I feel that just putting it out there and not contextualizing it, and also not being sensitive to the fact that you have children whose ancestors may have been enslaved,
right?
And you have children in the class whose ancestors may have been slave masters. So why not use both and say, you know what, put it out there.
I think that also happens too when that's the first time that they talk about race in a classroom. You know, if that's the first time you're talking about race, then everybody is looking at your black students. But if you're talking about identity and you are truly honoring all your students in your classroom, and you're teaching true history, and you're not teaching about, you know, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. I mean, if you're teaching true history, then that's not going to be, then let's all stare at the black kids when we talk about people being enslaved. It's going to be more of a natural part of the dialogue in our room. But so often, we're not comfortable talking about identities in our classroom still.
Right, because the identity, because white people, whiteness is seen as the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it is not discussed. It's interesting. Even this morning, I was at Panera Bread in Latham, New York. I was the only person of color in Latham. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my goodness, I'm the only person of color in Panera.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is so interesting. And I said to myself, I bet you nobody else noticed that.
Right, right.
You know, and I think we know that 50% of our students nationwide are students of color.
Mm-hmm.
80% of the teachers are white.
Mm-hmm.
And something has to be done.
Right.
Unfortunately, within the next 5 years, we can't switch it. It's very hard to change that demographic
right
overnight, right? Because people have to go to school, get their bachelor's, get their master's, and try to pass that exam, which is really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I read a report that it was easier to pass the bar than the teacher exam.
You know what? When we took the teacher exam here in New York, I had already been teaching in Boston. My husband was already a teacher in Boston. And we took it in New York, and my husband had said, English is my fifth language. You know, could I have extended time on the teacher's exam? And New York State Department of Ed said, absolutely not. And I just thought, like, what are you testing here? What are your goals? Like, you know, he was teaching in another state, but it's almost back to like us being so centered on the standard English, you know, our standard of English, our standard of whiteness, and not being open to anything other than that. And you talk about 80% of teachers being white, and you know, teachers, like I was just saying to you about that book I loved, we get very very emotional, very married to our curriculum. You know, there are units that we love teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And we really need to start stepping back and looking at that, because a lot of the things we do are very centered in whiteness, and we're not looking at how this affects our students. You know, I think about, like, we talk about, there's been a lot of debate about the canon that they use in schools, and what books are the ones that they always have to read every single year. We have them in our elementary schools, you know, middle schools, high school. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of debate about, like, To Kill a Mockingbird, which is so, like, I mean, it feels like everybody, your kids read it. I know they did because they went through this district. My children read it in their district.
Right.
And I mean, people might feel like that's a good book to teach for different literary devices or
right
something like that. But too often, it's being used as our diverse book. It's too often being used as our book to talk about racism. And it's honestly very scary to me that people are using this to talk about racism, because it's not a good book unless you want to talk about how racist the white people were in that story. But it goes back to when we're talking about centering a story and looking at our curriculum and, you know, who is centered in our stories. If we're using To Kill a Mockingbird, it is not the black man who is falsely accused of rape that is centered in that story. It's a white family. And too many of the books that we use in our schools, our black characters are just these side characters who are used to just further the story of the white character. They're just there to, like, add little things so the white character can grow and be a better person. But they're side stories. And that's what a lot of our students are seeing. That's their reflection of what they're seeing.
And when you say To Kill a Mockingbird, thank you for the reminder. One of my sons, he was very, very upset because the educator read the N-word, like, and in reading the text, read the word out loud. So my son came home very, very, very upset and said, "Mommy, when I leave the classroom, the white children are sneering at me and are making comments like, well, if the teacher can say the N-word out loud, why can't I say it? So they're sneering and saying the N-word as they're leaving the class and they're looking at me. So of course, mommy marches to the school and has a meeting with the educator and says, I truly do not appreciate you using the N-word and saying it out loud because it is a very violent word for everybody. It's not only violent for Black people, it's violent for white people and brown people and all people. And the educator proceeded to tell me how he has been teaching this text for years and that he knows history and that he's not going to change his practice. And I said, okay, and what can I do in a situation like that?
And it, you know, it puts your child in such a bad position too, because like I said, my husband's a teacher too, and we actually always said to our children, at the end of the day, the teacher has all the power. Like let's not pretend that it's any different from that. At the end of the day, your child is the one who's in the classroom with that teacher. And honestly, it's chilling to me to think that any teacher would be all right using that word. Period. And to think about your son sitting in the room and having to listen to that again and again and again, which is in its many times in that book, is sick. It's sickening, and it's sickening too that more people aren't outraged by it. You know, it just sort of reminded me of like when my children are biracial; they both identify as Black. Mm-hmm. That when my son was in high school, it was actually right after Trump was elected. Students started wearing wearing Confederate flags in school, and my son was really upset about it. And I spoke to an administrator, and the administrator said to me, "You know, so I'm a teacher, and I know what I'm going to say to an administrator. So I say this is causing a substantial disruption in your school, and I know that that's New York State. You know, that's one of the terms they use. And the administrator, I will never forget this, said to me, there are not enough Black kids in the school for it to be a substantial disruption. Because even if he didn't, it was like insinuated that if every Black student was upset, that's not substantial because there aren't enough Black kids there. And I just said to him, you know, I would certainly hope that you would have white teachers and white students that were offended by this symbol too. But I just the thought that that my child's education could be derailed and it not be viewed as substantial by, you know, and this was the district, you know, I had moved to because we had left another district. Because in the first district we were in, there were children that were not allowed to play with my daughter. Because there were parents that told their children that Black girls were dangerous. There were racial jokes that happened. My daughter was in first grade, like coming home telling us racial jokes that were being told. It was really bad.
And her first grade.
By first grade peers. And, you know, and then you think about privilege again. My husband and I had bought a house in that district, and we were in the financial position that we were able to sell our house and buy a house in another district. Well, how many families don't have that kind of privilege to be able to leave where they are? There are so many families that don't have that privilege to say, my kids don't deserve to be in this district.
Well, I'll tell you, it gave me just shudders to hear that experience you had, and I feel, you know, very sad because they did not see that a student of color, they didn't have the numbers were substantial enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because was the school only created for a certain type of student? I mean, it's for all students. And, you know, as you were talking about the call to action, it doesn't matter whether we are a Democrat or whether we're a Republican, we all have hearts, we all have souls, we all have minds. We all, whether we're Black, White, Latinx, Asian, multiracial, biracial, Indian, Afghanistan, whatever ethnicity, we all absolutely want the same thing for our children, which is a good education. And therefore, with the election coming up, I think school districts, you really need to think about and reflect on what kind of school do you want for the students in your classroom? Because you did not become a teacher or an educator or administrator for white students or for Black students or Latinx students or LGBTQIA students. You came to be, when you were a little boy, a little girl, or however you identify in terms of your sexual identity, you did not say, I want to be a teacher because I want to help a certain group. You said, I want to be a teacher because I want to teach and I love learning and I want to be back in the school environment. So as you're thinking about that, the call to action is you need to have these conversations. Because whether you believe it or not, they are happening in your school.
Yes.
No matter how you think it is, I challenge you, go to your data and look at your disproportionality numbers and tell me what they say to you. Because numbers don't lie. I guarantee you, your numbers are showing disproportionality. Mm-hmm. Even if you have 10% of your students of color, what are the suspension rates for them? I guarantee you they're different. What are your suspension rates for students of special needs? What are your suspension rates for them? Look at those numbers. Those numbers do not lie. So if you say, well, you know, we're doing fine, we don't have these things happening, they are happening, whether you believe it or not.
Right.
Look at your numbers.
And the truth is that decentering whiteness in our curriculum is going to make the curriculum better for all students. This is not just benefiting students of color. This is benefiting all of our students to be talking about, honestly, about what has happened in the history of our country, how we've gotten to where we are, to be showing, you know, different identities to our students when we're reading books, when we're doing picture books, when we're doing chapter books. All of these things that they make everybody better. They make, you know, I had recently told a story about these posters that I have in my classroom. My husband has the same class posters. And one of them says unapologetically queer. My husband has had more students come out to him since he has had that poster quietly in his room. He's never had students come out to him, and he has put that poster up, and he has had students approach him and quietly tell him that they were gay or they are bisexual. And it's these things that we do, these things where we welcome all identities in our classroom, that just let kids like breathe a sigh of like knowing that they're safe, you know, knowing that we've got them. And that benefits everybody. And cultivating that empathy in our community benefits everybody.
And I agree. And what I think is great about with that poster is your husband is telling the students that they belong here.
Mm-hmm.
And belonging is something we crave for. You know, it's something that we crave for. We all want to belong. And when we don't feel like we belong, then we exit.
Mm-hmm.
And so how many of our students feel like they don't belong and come in only body, but not in spirit and soul? And if you don't belong or feel like you're welcome and you can't be fully present with completely who you are, then you'll never manifest all the gifts, all the talents that you possess. Because when you come to school, you feel like you need to leave part of you at the door.
Mm-hmm.
How many children think that being smart is white, a white thing,
right?
And they try to dumb down so they cannot be associated as being white.
Mm-hmm.
So what can we do as educators to make sure everyone knows that their fullness is celebrated and not only a certain group of students?
Oh,
that was really a great conversation. It was so wonderful to spend time with you, Tracy. Thank you so much for sharing your stories. And thank you all for listening to our podcast today.
Thank you, Kathleen. It was really good to talk to you. And I really appreciate everybody listening and thinking about what we had to say.
All right. Have a good day, everyone.